Our Buckminster Fuller once said, "We are called to be architects of the future, not its victims." Welcome to episode 39 of Our Hen House, a place to find our way to change the world for animals. In today's episode, Marianne and I will report back from our much-anticipated launch party for Our Hen House, where our speakers wowed us, the food impressed us, and the crowd, which delighted us, spilled out onto the sidewalk. We'll also give you an exciting update about our Time Out New York article, and we'll express our thoughts on why people need to share the love when it comes to Ellen DeGeneres.
Yes!
Even if they don't think she's perfect.
Like you're perfect!
Joining us today is animal rights lawyer David Wolfson, who is a partner in the global corporate group at Milbank, Tweed, Hadley, and McCloy. David has some exciting news for us regarding undergraduate academia that you won't want to miss.
Amazing.
For our review section, we will talk fast food. Vegan fast food, of course. All that, some vegan banter, and of course, tons of current events from the world of animal rights. My name is Jasmine Singer, and I'll be your co-host today in Our Hen House, along with my space cadet, Marianne Sullivan. Now please, pull up some hay. Let's get squawking. I'd like to welcome my co-host, Marianne Sullivan.
Hello, my little rocket ship.
Why?
Because you were launched this week.
Funny. Yes, I was launched, as were you, and Our Hen House was launched. We did it! It's
finally,
over!
Thank God.
So, what'd you think?
Well, I mean, it would be hard to not say that it went very well, because it went awfully well.
It was
perfect. I'm trying to be...
humble.
I don't want to be self-aggrandizing, show-offy, but it went very, very well.
It was unbelievable. It truly was. I'm still
Where did we come
shocked.
Up with those people?
No idea. And we didn't know most of them, which is
I know,
even
and
better.
Then there were people there, apparently, who have told me they were there. I didn't even see them.
Well, there were like 250 people there, which if you've been to Mushu's, it doesn't hold 250 people.
They did push all of the stuff to the side, so
right.
It held more people than
then
it
you
would
think.
Normally.
And there was sidewalk spillage, lots of sidewalk spillage.
It was kind of like when the way people talk about their weddings, you know,
right.
Like it was all a blur. That's how I feel about that night. It was all
so,
wait, a blur.
So you don't remember the part where we got married? You don't remember that part?
No,
it was
I
amazing.
Don't.
We had a stage and microphones, which I know if you haven't been to Mushu's, sounds like nothing, but it's just cool to have that in a space like that. And the raffle prizes.
And everybody loved the raffle prizes.
Really, Robin Lazara, our key volunteer raffle coordinator, did a phenomenal job getting, I mean, we all pitched in, but Robin spearheaded that.
Yeah, she did that.
And
yeah.
It was just truly...
Well, she grouped the prizes so that they were really mega prizes. They,
sure.
We could have had 40 prizes.
Right.
But instead,
we had
10. And each had, like, several different really good things in it. And
yeah.
Most, I think that makes a lot more sense. I think people are more willing to buy a ticket when for big prizes.
Right. And most
and
of
also
the,
it would have just taken all night to give away all of those prizes if they hadn't been grouped.
I know. I think people would have gotten tired of hearing numbers called and probably even more disappointed if they didn't win.
Yeah,
because
that's
it's like,
true.
You know, you're the three people who didn't win. But we had the prizes were worth like several hundred dollars at least each.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And we had signed books. We had shoes from Elizabeth Olsen. We had gift certificates to restaurants all over New York City and to websites. We had
Tofu Express.
The Tofu Express. Oh, yeah.
Express.
Right.
To press your tofu and get the water out of it. I just love that.
Well, we're going to be reviewing that on an upcoming podcast episode.
Excellent.
And, I mean, we could go on and on about the raffles, but let's move
on
to the speakers.
It's not really that interesting.
Well, not to people who didn't win. But the speakers were so phenomenal. We had Jane Velez Mitchell, who
she was hilarious.
Us up.
She was hilarious.
She said...
She is crazy.
She said that... I don't even know how to say this, but she said, in 50 years, they're going to give a tour of the Lower East Side, and they're going to stop here and say, this is where our hen house started.
It was totally ridiculous.
Yeah, we're going to actually make a video of the event, she gave me some footage, and it was mostly of her speech and of my grandmother's speech, which I'll get to in a second. But we're going to make a video, and the wonderful photos that Jessica Mahade, who was on our show last week, took. She's a brilliant photographer. But yes, and in addition to Jane, my grandma.
I know, Sherry was great.
She stole the show. Yeah. I said, "Grandma, you're so good." And she said, "I know."
Yeah, well, why be humble when you're that good?
Right, exactly. There's no point. People are emailing me who I've never met just to tell me that she was so wonderful. She really was. She talked about the changing face of food throughout. She's 86. She's vegetarian. For those of you who have been living under a slab of tofu, she just went vegetarian this summer. And she's truly a remarkable human being. And Victoria Moran was just
great.
Beautiful.
She was really great.
She was
She's so pretty.
She's so pretty.
And Joshua was great.
Joshua Katcher, the discerning brute, he's always great. And
yeah. Well, these people were.
And Dan Peraro.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot about
Dan. On our advisory.
He was our special guest.
Well, because he was a very last minute guest.
As always, extremely
funny. He called himself the cock of our hen house. And we had musicians. We had Jen London.
The food I hear was great, even though I didn't get any of it.
Well, hold on a second. We still have more performers. We had the musicians, Jen London, who was a singer-songwriter, who was amazing.
And the cellist.
And the cellist, Elizabeth Glushko, blew my mind. Just cello is such a beautiful instrument that we don't hear nearly enough. And like you said, the food, we had Sarah Sohn from Sweet and Sarah. We had Rescue Chocolates. We had Raw Ice Cream Company, a cake by Laura Darty, and faux gras from the Regal Vegan, which we've reviewed.
It was all really good.
So here, we got home and went out for Chinese food at midnight.
No, I didn't get any food.
No, me neither. No, but it was truly a really amazing event.
So I've heard. And the whole thing is a blur to me.
We made a lot of money.
That's good.
It wasn't even a fundraiser. The admission was free.
That's good.
I think a lot of people
might have... We sold our tote bags.
I know, which...
Sold a bunch of them.
Which we're launching on our website.
I love those tote bags.
I do, too.
It's a problem, though, that we're both carrying them, because I keep picking up yours.
Well, I had a button on mine, my vegan lesbian button thing, but I can't find it. Like, fell off somewhere.
Oh, that's bad.
No, I think I threw it in a pocket of some jeans.
Does that mean you're no longer a vegan lesbian?
No, it means that there's a button in a pocket of my jeans somewhere.
But other than that, I do love the tote bag.
They are the most...
ethical. They're like the most ethical product on the face of the planet.
What did you say, that little vegans sewed them together under tofu right. trees? They are. They're made out of soda bottles and water bottles, and they're gorgeous, and we've talked about them for weeks now, but now you can see them on our website. If you can't right now, then you will be able to very shortly. So, yeah, they were really exciting and fun, and it was, you know, all in all, a blast, truly. And the Time Out New York article, I think it helped us tremendously. I mean, that was, what a coup, right? I mean, am I allowed to say that? That it was a coup?
I don't know how... I really don't know how to approach reporting on this past week without sounding like we're bragging.
A bitch, right. But I have one more thing to say, just to sound like I'm bragging, but please know that I'm not a braggy type. We just we just got our Time Out New York in the mail, not the one from last week that we were in, but
and
this week.
And we were so sad that Time Out New York was coming out again today, and so we would no longer be in the issue.
But we're in the issue.
We are. I have to admit.
The letter to the editor section, which is a very small section that only published 5 articles. 2 of them are about us.
You mean 5 letters?
5 letters. 2 of them are about us, including the letter of the week.
I know. Like, what's going on?
I'm not, you know what? I want to read it, but I'm not going to, because then I would just, like, have to... I can't read it. But you have to... If you're listening to... Oh, right. Okay, I'll say who wrote it. So, Sandy Swiss wrote...
Yeah, I love Sandy Swiss.
And
it was so sweet.
And Abby Bean wrote another one of... I just thought that, like, a mouse was playing with my leg, but it was Rose... Just like
a
gigantic.
That's really fortunate.
Yeah, but it was Rose. She's playing with my leg. So that was, I mean, it's been quite a week. And one thing that we blogged about this week was that Ellen DeGeneres is going to be the face of Farm Sanctuary's Adopt a Turkey project, which is amazing, really amazing for Farm Sanctuary and for farm animals everywhere. She's coming out and saying to consider adopting a turkey this year instead of eating one. And we blogged about it very excitedly because Ellen DeGeneres is amazing. And let's just say Halloween's coming up, but I'm not going to say any more than that. Anyway.
Nobody is going to understand what you just said.
You might. Someone might. So anyway, regardless, We've gotten some really annoying comments regarding that.
Yeah, and
every time
didn't get
we post anything about Ellen DeGeneres, we get these comments. I know she's a spokesperson for CoverGirl.
All right, calm down, calm down.
I agree that's sucky, but that does not lose all of Ellen DeGeneres' goddamn credibility. She's the most famous vegan in the world, and she has done more single-handedly for farm animals than anybody else in the history of the world, as far as I'm concerned, ever.
Oh, sweetheart, you're so emotional.
So for
about
people
Ellen.
to say that she is not the should not be an ambassador for farm animals is truly insane, and those people are insane who say that. I mean, you have to weigh the good with the bad here. Yes, Ellen should not be the spokesperson for CoverGirl. However, we don't know what's going on contractually. She's a recent vegan. It is very possible she was under contract before she went vegan, before she knew about these issues. People don't consider that. I agree it's shitty, but that does not mean... Rose is upset too. She's barking. I'm sorry. Just take me off my soy milk crate.
Calm down. Okay. Yeah, I think that the CoverGirl thing, I mean, I assume, it's kind of like... the very rich, famous person version of still using your leather shoes until they wear out. Mm-hmm. She still has this contract.
I like that analogy.
I don't know whether that's what's going on. I'm assuming it. But it is unfortunate that people seem to focus solely on the fact that she still is a spokesperson for CoverGirl and don't balance that against all of the unbelievable good that she's done, that she has mainstreamed, pretty much single-handedly mainstreamed the word vegan.
Yeah.
And like, she's incredibly famous. People just don't seem to to weigh the difference between people who are kind of sort of famous and who are incredibly famous, people who are famous locally or have a following or whatever. And Ellen, who is hugely famous and is mainstream in the whole concept of veganism.
Yeah, I'm just tired of people who are losing sight of the big picture and get caught up in their own crap. I mean, obviously, I agree that you should never support any company that tests on animals. But... you have to figure this with the big picture, people. You just have to. It's like people like to hear themselves talk. That's what I feel like the answer is. Do you agree?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. It just does seem like people really sometimes want to find fault and don't want to see the positive side, which is really sad because we have so few positive sides to look at. Yeah. And Ellen's got to be one of the bright spots. She's got to be one of the things that's got to make us feel good about what's going on.
She makes me feel good.
I know, honey. There's a little too much of that going on.
Another thing that makes me feel good is David Wolfson, who you've known for, I don't know, a million years and is on our podcast today. So excited about this.
David is a really good friend of mine.
He is.
And that's not just an animal rights friend.
He's a real friend. Well, we met through Marisa and David. Marisa's been on our podcast before. We've met through them, so we owe quite a lot to them. We'll name our next stuffed animal Marisa and David. Anyway, David's going to be talking about what we talked about in our news last week, which is the incredible new program that's coming to NYU, and that's about all I'll say about that.
I can't wait to hear what he's going to say.
Me neither. Let's get right to that. David Wolfson is a partner in the global corporate group at Milbank, Tweed, Hadley, and McCloy. David currently teaches animal law at Columbia Law School as a lecturer in law and NYU School of Law, where he is an adjunct professor. David has previously taught at Cardozo, Harvard, and Yale. He has also written extensively in the area and represents HSUS and Farm Sanctuary on a number of issues, including ballot initiative measures. Welcome to our hen house, David.
Delighted to be here, guys.
Happy to have you. We understand that there is a very exciting development at NYU, where you currently teach in the law school. Can you tell us about what's going on?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Basically, what's happening, as you said correctly, I'm an adjunct professor in the NYU Law School, where I teach animal law. And what's going on is that, basically, NYU is creating an animal studies initiative. We are very excited by this because it shows a real commitment on behalf of NYU in a growing field. And the Animal Studies Initiative is going to be housed in the Environmental Studies Department.
Wow.
It's going to be headed up by a guy called Dale Jameson, who is just a terrific guy and a leading academic in the environmental field, but of particular excitement to us, is really one of the first academics in the animal protection field. Years ago, he was writing stuff about this. And this is going to be an initiative that has a lot of different aspects to it. It's going to have a whole focus and a whole number of different areas of animal issues. Some of them may be animals in the arts, accessing the terrific faculty they have in the School of Arts or in literature and so on. Maybe there'll be issues of animal behaviorism, you know, a whole bunch of cultural issues, literature, as well as studying the animal-human connection and interactions both at the political level, the legal level, the public policy level, and the ethics level. And the idea is to start to create a real academic movement here where the subject becomes more and more of valued and of worth. And of the thing that we're most excited about, and we can chat a little bit later as how this came about, but we're most excited about the animal studies minor that is being created.
Wow.
So there will be now a minor you can take, like a major or a minor, and if you go to NYU as an undergraduate, you will be able to graduate with a minor in animal studies, where you'll be able to take a certain number of courses, all these types of courses that I've just described, and when you come out of it, you'll have a minor in expertise in animal studies. And while there are certainly a few other places that have done this, I think that the fact that something like somewhere like NYU is doing it at this level across the board with all of their institutions that are involved makes this a really unique event.
I just can't believe it. I'm so excited about this. I just totally want to go back to school.
Yeah, I know. I wish it had happened when I was there. Absolutely.
So how did it all come about?
Well, it's all due to the incredible kindness and vision of Brad Goldberg. Brad Goldberg is a philanthropist. He is a guy that worked on Wall Street for a long period of time. But
he's been on our podcast.
Excellent. I was going to ask you if he's been on you. So you know who Brad is. Brad is, you know, really had an incredibly disciplined and really thoughtful approach to investing his donations into various parts of the movement that he feels will make a real difference in a really productive way. And he has been happy enough to, or kind enough to give a $1 million gift to NYU for this program. And it came about really because Brad was thinking for a long time that he wanted to grow the area of animal studies at the undergraduate level, somewhat similar to the way that Bob Barker has been growing the study of animal law throughout law schools. And he really wanted to focus on an institution that he had a relationship with and that would be taken very seriously and that was of an incredibly high level. And because of a relationship that I have with Dale and the fact that I was in NYU, we all get together to talk about it, and from that, the whole thing happened.
Wow, that's just unbelievable. It's so exciting. David, will you be teaching a course as part of this new program? And if
yes,
so...
Yes, I will. I will.
Oh,
I'm very excited about it.
What will it cover?
Well, that's a good question because I haven't designed the course yet. But the idea is I teach animal law at NYU in Columbia. And the focus of animal law, the way I teach it, deals with not only animal law issues, but issues of ethics and public policy. And I've also practiced, a large area of my practice has been in the area of passing laws and public policy, government regulation, and so on, working with Farm Sanctuary and the Humane Society of the United States, in particular on ballot initiatives. So I've been asked to teach a public policy class, which in my mind will have a whole host of issues, both legal issues and political issues and how you affect change for animal, to improve animal treatment and to get better animal protection, as well as, in my mind, a bunch of stuff on ethics and cultural issues. It's just going to be a lot of fun. I'm going to basically make it up with a lot of people's help. And I'm particularly excited to be teaching undergraduates, not because I don't love teaching law students, they're fantastic, but just because it's a different group of people, and I think there are going to be certain elements of the way undergraduates approach the subject that will be a lot of fun. And also, I think it makes a big difference at that level.
I totally agree with you. I can't believe that this hasn't started before this, because I think that so many students will be interested in it, and I think it will just catch on like wildfire with a school as prestigious as NYU doing it. But why, aside from the fact that students are passionate about this issue like so many of us, why should they study animal issues? Is there any kind of a career path here? Do you really see this as leading to people going out and actually changing the world, or is it just to satisfy their interests? Do you see this as making actual change?
I do. I mean, and just to clarify for a second in response to your first, the last statement you made, I mean, as I said before, there are a few other places that do this type of program. Drury is starting to put something together. I know there are other institutions that are doing it. But I do agree with you. I think the fact that it's going to happen at NYU the way it's happening makes us distinct. And your question is basically, why are we doing it? What do we think we'll get out of it? And it's hard to predict exactly what's going to happen. That's what's exciting about it, right, is that you get the opportunity to introduce the whole next generation of undergraduate students to this issue, and what they take out of the class is what's going to make the difference, and what they do with that knowledge is what's going to make the difference. But I think it's a natural evolution of a particular social justice movement. I mean, you can view the animal protection movement as a social justice movement, similar to other social justice movements. And I think if you look at other movements, whether it be women's rights, gay rights, environmental issues, part of the process of society taking the issue seriously and the issue moving from the back of the room into the middle or the front of the room is it being taken seriously as part of the academic movement and being treated as a serious and separate topic, whether it be through environmental law classes or an environmental major or minor in environmental studies. And the very process of having this, I think, it builds the momentum and generates the possibility of a whole host of academic or non-academic careers. I don't think necessarily that someone will have a minor in animal studies and that will necessarily lead them right into a particular career path, but I could easily see someone with a public policy or political science or even any other degree with the animal minor and the experiences that they had being carried through their career so that maybe they decide to take the step onto the animal law path or into animal advocacy or working for the government in regulatory areas where animal issues are relevant. Maybe they become excited to do academic work. But more importantly, I think that just whenever they go on in their life and do whatever they end up doing, whenever they're confronted with these issues, whether it be in an active role of actually having a role in making the law a certain way or a policy a certain way, a corporate policy, for example, I think they'll be much more educated and supportive of the issue, or whether it's just because they vote and they are encouraged to persuade other people to vote a certain way in connection with a certain measure. So for me, what's really exciting about the measure is that all of the possibilities are unknown, but without this, the possibilities that are unknown would never even have a chance of happening. So now we're going to, you know, just light the fire and see what happens, basically.
David, you were one of the very first people doing farm animal law. When did you write Beyond the Law?
Oi. Beyond the
that
Law.
That long ago, huh?
Yeah, Beyond the Law, the initial draft of Beyond the Law was written in 1991 to 1992.
Wow.
And then we published it, Henry Spira and I was working with Henry Spira, and he published it out of his own pocket because he believed in it. And I think it was probably published in 1994,
Wow. The
first publication. Then it was republished in the Animal Law Journal. But, yeah, I've been involved in farmed animal law issues for probably 20 years now. Animal rights before that, but farmed animal issues 20 years.
And I know that you were really the main impetus for Marianne getting involved with very deeply with farm animal law issues. So you're really the one who started that whole path going. How did you get involved in farm animal issues to begin with? You said you were involved with just animal rights in general before then. Why farm animal law? What started that?
Well, I had, you know, I imagine like many people you've spoken to, we all just sort of, well, I guess everyone comes in different paths. My path was I was always just sort of aware of them being animals, like when I was a kid. Whether it because I had dogs and I had a particularly, you know, close relationship with certain dogs we had, or whether it's because when I saw animals in the wild or in other environments, I was just always fascinated by them and always aware of their unique qualities on the planet. I mean, the fact that they were clearly thinking and able to suffer. It wasn't like I gave it a lot of intellectual thought, but it was never something that I for one second thought wasn't the case. When I was like in my early, I think when I was like 9 or 10, I stopped trying to eat meat. I tried to not eat meat for like a week at school.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was 16, I saw a movie called The Animals Film, which was narrated by Julie Christie, which is on in England, which is where I'm from. And that really affected me, and it showed all the ways that animals are utilized in our society. And it became clear to me that it was wrong. And it also became clear to me that certain things that I was doing was wrong. But I wasn't prepared to change my lifestyle at that point. I just felt uncomfortable with the place. I was hypocritical or inconsistent, but I was okay with that. It just was something I put on the side. Then when I went to undergraduate to college, I got involved in the student animal rights group, Students for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And that just was when I read Peter Singer around that time. And Peter Singer was just a revelation to me, not because his arguments were revelatory in the sense that they were brilliant, but it wasn't something that I thought was, wow, I'd never thought about. It was more like I thought, well, of course, this is the most obvious argument I've ever heard. This makes total sense. Oh, yeah, that's another of course point.
Right.
And he took it, obviously, a place I could never take it because he's a genius. But it really impacted me, and I just realized that, you know, I was it wasn't something that I could defend anymore, so I stopped eating meat at that point. How I got to farmed animals, because I was involved in animal issues, was really because I became aware of the overwhelming number of farmed animals as opposed to all the other animals that humans utilize or interact with. And it became evident to me that it made no sense. Well, it made the most sense to focus on farmed animals. All the other issues are incredibly important, but you really weren't making any significant change in the way animals were treated as a whole if you focused on the other issues. And at the same time, when I was in law school, I became aware of the way that the law treats farmed animals and the inconsistencies. And from an academic perspective, and I think this is where Marianne and I really connected, was the chutzpah of the way that farmed animals are excluded from the law just sort of aroused my passion. And I also very much believed from the beginning that it was an area that was ripe for change and extremely accessible by the animal protection movement. Maybe that's because I came from the UK where I'd seen significant change happen already. I don't know why, but when I started in the animal rights movement in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, no one was focusing on farmed animal issues. It was more vivisection and fur, and there was a sense that it wasn't the right approach to take, but I never felt that way. I always felt that it was absolutely the right approach to take, and that's clearly how Marianne felt as well. So that's how I got involved in it.
So tell us about the point you were trying to make in Beyond the Law and whether you feel that things have changed since then.
Well, I mean, I guess at the end of the day, there are sort of two to three very basic points in all of Marianne and my work. And they are, you know, one, as I pointed out, that the overwhelming number of animals that we interact with are farmed animals. And I'm sure many speakers have said that on your talk show. You know, basically, if you add up every animal in the world that we interact with, either because we experiment in them or we use them for fur or we even keep them as pets or we use them in zoos or circuses or we eat them or you put them all in the middle of the room, 98% of that number are farmed animals. So they're clearly relevant from that perspective. Secondly, the way that animals are treated, you know, in intensive confinement and farm practices is very, very unpleasant for a whole host of reasons. And there are economically defensible reasons as to why to do it, but from a sort of ethical basis, even if you want to eat meat, which I still think there's no real reason to eat meat, certainly not in the United States, but even if you wanted to, it's hard to justify the way animals are raised. And then you come to the sort of the final part of the argument, which is, and I think that most Americans, if you ask them how are farmed animals raised for food, they say, you know what, I don't need to know about it. I'm sure it's not particularly pleasant, but I'm pretty certain that there are laws out there that deal with it and that there's a government agency that's responsible for it and there's someone out there making sure it doesn't go too bad. Whereas, in fact, as Beyond the Law argued, and this is the basic point, was that that was completely not the truth. In fact, the farmed animal industry had made a particularly intense effort to alter all of the anti-cruelty statutes, which are the laws that would have dealt with farmed animals, to exempt common or normal farming practices. And so that was sort of the kicker of the whole book, or booklet, as I like to call it, because it's not really very long at all, which is that the animals are a huge number, they're treated badly, people think there are laws to protect them, but there aren't any laws to protect them. And that means this is a very, very bad situation, and we need to do better. In respect of the second part of the question is, has it got better? I mean, I'd have to say, as a matter of fact, for the animals, that it's hard to imagine that there's a significantly less amount of animals suffering for food production in the United States today than there was 10, 20 years ago. I mean, the amount of animals has grown. It's settled a little bit lately, but it's grown that they're using for food. And the amount of animals that have been impacted by what we've done is really rather minimal. But I don't think that indicates that we haven't been successful. I think it's just that the impact is beginning and will grow. When you look at what has happened as a matter of law, there has been some significant progress at various state levels to ban various intensive confinement practices. If you look at it as a matter of cultural awareness and change, it's tremendous, largely because of the interactions between human health and environmental harm and climate change and antibiotic usage and workers' mistreatment. But society is more aware of this issue now than they've ever been. When I teach my classes, and I would think Marianne's probably the same, we should ask her, but when I teach my class, when I used to teach it, maybe one person was in the room for farmed animals. Now everyone's in there for farmed animal issues, mm-hmm. for environmental, climate change, diet, whatever. And then when you look at the amount of people that are becoming motivated to be involved in the animal movement, if you look at the quality of the students and individuals working in the movement, and when you look at the sense of public support for what we do, it's tremendous. And you got to remember that we started at zero. I mean, we started with everything against us and absolutely no interest in the society on this issue at all. And that state was probably the case 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And with any social movement, the most important thing you have to do is you have to create momentum. You have to have a starting point, you have to build up some speed, and you have to have some momentum. And what we've clearly done in the last 10 years is create a tremendous amount of momentum with a tremendous amount of change. So I'm very optimistic. I'm not blind to what's going on in Latin America. I'm not blind to what's going on to China. And I'm not blind to the fact that probably more animals are suffering today than they were 10 years ago. But I do believe that change is that there's real change and that in time it will improve in the United States and Europe for a reasonably significant amount of animals in some way. That doesn't mean it's going to be perfect by any means, but I do think it's not going to be as bad as it was.
Yeah, well, I think that's totally true, David. And obviously you've done a lot of work with Farm Sanctuary and the Humane Society of the United States, especially around the ballot initiative process. Can you talk a bit about your involvement?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the ballot initiative, as people are probably aware, is a particularly reasonably unique American phenomenon. It's in Switzerland as well, but it's a particularly powerful form of direct democracy. If your legislators won't do it, you can do it yourself. And, of course, one of the key problems with the way that you have to amend the laws in the United States is you tend to go through committees within Congress or state-level legislatures. And those committees tend to be agricultural committees for agricultural laws, and it's just not happening. It's just impossible to pass a law because the industry controls the process. So to have the ballot initiative process where you can basically get enough signatures on a particular measure, put it on the ballot, and if enough people agree with you at the election, you win, it's a fantastic educational tool and a fantastic tool for change. I got involved in the ballot initiative movement with Gene Bauer and Wayne Pacelli when we all came together and maybe 12 years ago decided that we should do a ballot initiative. Really, the three of us thought that up on farmed animal issues. Wayne had been doing it on a whole host of other measures. He's a master at it, and his HSUS team are masters at it, and they've been doing it. But Gene and I put a lot of pressure on Wayne to do a farmed animal measure, and the real question was, well, would people care? It's one thing to put on a measure, you know, hunting mountain lions or slaughtering horses or puppies or trapping cruel traps for wildlife. It's another thing to ask people to vote for more space for a pig when they're eating the pig. So there was a lot of concern initially in the movement that that was just not a tenable argument, that Americans wouldn't grab it. Gene and I felt very strongly that that was wrong and that actually they would be supportive of very minimal welfare measures to begin a process of change. And so we sat down with Wayne and we thought about it for a long time and then we drafted the language for Florida, which was a gestation crate initiative, the very first one. And we did the polling, and the polling indicated a great deal of support for the measure. And so we went for the campaign. It was a reasonably expensive campaign, we thought, at the time. But when you compare it to the amount of money spent in California when we did Prop 2, it was a tiny amount of money. Mm-hmm. And we were successful with 55% of the vote. And then we felt, that's great, you know, let's keep going, because every time we win one of these things, we can expand it. So in Arizona, we did gestation crates and field crates. In California, we did gestation crates, field crates, and battery cages. And then in Ohio, the deal that was struck, it had a whole host of things going on. And then you got Michigan, you got Colorado, got all the stuff that came out of it, all because we could point to the fact that people, when asked the simple question, do you support a measure that will give animals a better life while they're being raised for food, will support that. And that's how it all came about.
The ballot initiative process is, of course, continuing. I assume there will be more, and it's moving into state legislatures. But aside from that movement to get the most egregious confinement measures banned, what are the next steps for farm animal law? Do you see any potential for going federal or something else?
It's a good question. I mean, it's a very tricky process. I mean, you're right that there'll be more ballot initiative measures, and there'll probably be more state legislative efforts without ballot initiative measures, because one of the advantages you have, like in Michigan, is we said we were going to do one, and they said, okay, we'll pass the law anyway. So you can use the consequence of a ballot measure to actually get legislative reform. That happened in Colorado, too. So there will be more state legislative efforts, but there will undoubtedly also be other methods of change. I mean, labeling is something that people are thinking about, and consumer preferences and so on. Pointing to federal change is a very, you know, smart thing to look at. It has advantages that we can't get at the ballot initiative level on a state-by-state basis, because we can only change each state as they come up, and their laws may be slightly different, and there are some states we're not going to have a shot at, and it costs a lot of money. So naturally, you think it would make sense to go to the federal level and get federal reform. And that's true, presuming that you can get it. And I don't think we can get it today. I think we will get it in the future. But you can't get it before, in my opinion, it's a mistake to get a piece of federal reform before you have enough political weight behind you to guarantee that the reform you get will stick. Because one of the lessons of the animal protection movement in the last 30 years is there have been great pieces of federal legislation passed on paper that, while still of value, fall short from the ideals and the vision that was expressed at the time of their enactment. Mm-hmm. And that was because too much deference was given to the regulatory body that was entitled to enforce it. Perhaps the language wasn't drafted as well. Perhaps only so much could get done at the time. And one of the political battles you have to work with in this area is that when you pass the law, it can be hard to revisit it. And it can also be harder to argue to the American public that there's a need for a law if there's a law in place, even if it's a bad one. Because that, you know, arguing why laws are bad is not that easy. It's a lot easier to argue that there's no law at all. So I'm all in favor of a federal law when we have the political weight to make sure that it works out in the way that it needs to, and it's enforced by the right people and has the proper stick. And, of course, that's a very complicated process, because you don't get it passed without cutting deals with the opposition. So it's a process that I think has to happen and will happen, but I think we have to be very careful to not make a mistake and do it too soon.
So, David, you've written a bunch of articles alongside Marianne.
Mm-hmm.
How did your friendship survive?
How did our friendship survive while working together?
Yes,
that's a great question. It survived.
Barely.
It survived barely. I mean, Marianne and I, this is of great interest to all your listeners, I know. Marianne and I have a terrific working relationship that's based on pain and distress. And,
so
you know,
true.
we each have terrible work habits. Marianne doesn't want to do something. I don't want to do the other thing. We hope that the other one will pick it up. The other one does. The other one doesn't. And it's awfully painful until, and then we write something, and then it's wrong. It's just wrong, and we don't know how to fix it, and it's just wrong. And then usually Marianne, I might add, realizes what's wrong with it and turns it upside down or removes a section or fixes it, mm-hmm. and suddenly it works. And then I probably have a bit of better strength of the final edit. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's, I don't know why, but I that's something I can focus on. And then we always end up with something that's, I think, pretty damn good,
yeah.
although not necessarily what we thought we were going to write, and always worth the pain and the distress, just.
So when are you two going to write another one?
Yeah, right. I would love to when we have a good life and we can actually focus on it. I mean, people who are listening who write articles know that even a 25-page article can kill you.
Yeah.
And, you know, Marianne, she's a full-time practicing lawyer with a overseeing a huge appellate practice. She teaches animal law at a whole host of institutions. She does this project, you know, she's involved in thousands of things. I, you know, I'm a partner at a law firm where I practice mergers and acquisitions law. I teach at NYU in Columbia, and I have to do all the other things associated with that. And so to get the energy level to actually get one of these things done is very hard. That said, we both actually know exactly what the next article we write should be. Mm-hmm. Whether we write it or not is another question.
Are you going to tell us or no?
It's just the next stage of, I mean, we've written about lots of things. We wrote about the Israeli Supreme Court case and foie gras. We wrote about the New Jersey appellate court case and the recent Supreme Court decision is what we need to write about. But it's been fun because basically if you look at our writings, it's sort of a history of the farm animal legal movement and how the world has changed in reaction to the political efforts of animal protection advocates. And there's another chapter to be written about that.
Very good. Well, I'm sure people will eagerly await that, and I will eagerly await the final product. And
well,
the three trips
Marianne will go through. I'm sure.
Well,
you'll
I'm eagerly anticipating the 3 month vacation I'd take during the process.
Absolutely.
Anyway, thank you so much, David, for joining us. We're so excited about NYU. We can't even tell you how excited we are. And of course, you were a huge part of that happening, and Brad as well, of course, and Dale. So thank you so much for sharing that story with us today, and all of your other stories as well, and for doing everything you do for the animal rights movement, and for coming today to our hen house.
It was my pleasure, and you know, I hope any listeners that are undergraduates at NYU, you know, take the animal minor. I think it'll be great.
That's right. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
That was the fantastic David Wolfson, and now let's get right into some news, shall we? Lots of news today. Did you hear the debate that Jonathan Safran Foer had with Anthony Bourdain on CBC Radio?
Yeah, I did listen to it. It was kind of dopey. I shouldn't say that. I think people should definitely listen to it because I think listening to what Anthony Bourdain says gives you a lot of insight into the way meat eaters think. I mean, it's hard to even remember because none of it makes any sense. It has something to do with thinking that eating meat is a form of communication, mm-hmm. and we shouldn't give that up. And he says all this crazy stuff about whether he would eat a dog and whether he thinks that's unethical. It's just none of it makes sense.
And at the end of it, he said, Anthony Bourdain said that it was a lot healthier for kids to be vegan. And Jonathan Safran Foer said, oh, how do you, what are you basing that on? And there was some stumbling. And then Anthony Bourdain said, well, that's what my nutritionist told my kid. I have a 3.5-year-old. That's what they told my kid. It was such bullshit.
Yeah, everything is just bullshit.
Like, he's lying.
Yeah. Well, it's all, you know, meat industry built on lies and denial. But as I say, it is worth listening to because it gives you ways of approaching these crazy arguments, most of which are very similar, no matter who's making them.
And HSUS and PETA are, according to Eric Marcus from vegan.com, more trusted than factory farmers. Why is that?
Well, actually, it's not just according to Eric Marcus. More remarkably, it's according to an article in Farm Futures, farming magazine, and they found these surveys done by people connected to the meat industry that, yeah, HSUS and PETA are the most trusted. And that's kind of cool. And but after them is Farm Animal Veterinarians, very bad choice. USDA, really bad choice. And University Experts, which whatever that means, followed by state and national farm organizations, then small livestock farmers, and finally the large-scale livestock farmers. So it seems like the public is kind of getting its priorities straight about where to get its information, which is kind of really good news. And as Eric points out, this means that the more we get out there and make our case, the more people are listening to us. They're taking us seriously. Or they're taking, I shouldn't say us, because we're hardly HSUS. Yes, and PETA. But they are taking and some animal organizations seriously.
They actually trust our hen house above everyone else. It's amazing. It's truly amazing. Another thing that's amazing, but on a completely horrible level, is a Bosnian girl who filmed throwing half a dozen puppies into a river. And what's more amazing than that is that she's not going to be charged because of her age. And PETA has come out against this, thankfully.
Well, yeah, this was the story of the century. Actually, I don't think we even covered it when it happened because everybody was talking about it. This was the kind of story. Every once in a while, something hits so big that people outside the animal circle are all asking you about it, and they're all horrified about it, and they finally figured out who this girl was, and yeah, it's just so disturbing. I didn't actually watch the video because I had it described to me, and it's so sad. Like, apparently she's 12, and they can't charge her with anything, and in Bosnia, the penalties are only fines anyway. And it just goes to show you. I think this really caught the public imagination, and will create really bad kind of publicity for Bosnia. Not that Bosnia needs any bad publicity. It just amazes me how sometimes these stories just get so big and everybody's so angry.
Right.
And people were just furious about that.
Yeah, I was at the Mac store the other day, and I was having a one-to-one lesson, which is like a tutoring lesson, and it came up that I was an animal activist. And the guy said, "You must hate that football player." And I was like, I hate a lot more people, too.
You. I hate your friends. I hate your mom.
Oh, God, honey. Stop reading my mind. But you know who I don't hate?
Leah Michele. Natalie Portman.
Right. But yeah. Especially Leah Michele, because she's on Glee, which I love.
I do love that show. Yeah, that's a great show.
And Us Magazine just covered the story of Natalie Portman and Leah Michele going vegan. Us Magazine.
I know. Well, I mean, it's not news to any of us that they went vegan, because that's been big news for a while. But just like this big, well, I don't know, a really good article, small article in Us Magazine. And talked about the diet and talked about how it's good for their health and
how people should donate to charities.
How it makes them lose weight, which, you know, never worked out for me, but what the hell. Mentions Bill Clinton, mentions Chelsea. And then at the end, a little plug for Matt and Nat's bags, Urban Decay makeup. This is in Us Magazine. None of this is news. It's just news that it's in Us Magazine.
Yeah, that's really cool. And did you know that I used to take tap dancing with Natalie Portman?
Oh, sweetheart, this explains her great skill. She cheated off of you.
That's exactly what happened. So there's more news regarding Steve Wynn. What's going on?
Yeah,
there?
This is just a tiny little update. In it was a blog reported that not only, as we have reported before, Steve Wynn, the owner of Mega Hotels in Las Vegas, is providing that all of his restaurants and all of his hotels will provide vegan options. And now it turns out that he's distributed a DVD, which, by the way, I haven't heard about. We have to look that up. It's called Eating, the Third Edition, which talks about the impact of a vegan diet on the body and on the environment. Mm. He's distributed it to all of his employees, and there's a good deal of speculation that he himself has become vegan. So good for Steve. I love him.
You win some. You, Steve, win some. And that was our news. Before I forget, I want to quickly mention that there's a very special event happening this weekend on Sunday, 10-10-10, at 1 o'clock at Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary, their annual Thanksgiving celebration where they celebrate the turkeys in the fall. So if you can go to that, go to woodstocksanctuary.org. Marianne and I will be there. And now, I wonder why fast food is on our mind.
Maybe it's because we've been trying to eat so healthy. We're dreaming of junk.
I guess that's a possibility. So we did pose a Facebook question saying, what's your favorite vegan fast food from a non-vegan fast food place? And before we get into those answers, let's talk about a few of our possibilities. What about you?
Yeah, well, actually, when I posed this question, I was thinking primarily of chains. And I guess there are some people who just think it would be awful to ever eat at a chain. And I guess it is, but, you know, sometimes you're on the road or whatever, and there you are. So it's good to know a few options. And my favorite has always been the bean burritos without cheese from Taco Bell.
Yes, I actually had that. I was in Phoenix last year speaking at some event, and someone brought in a bunch of Taco Bell, which I was at first horrified by.
Oh, sweetie, you're so sensitive.
And then I thought it was the most delicious thing. Yeah. And it was like a dollar.
Yeah, they're so cheap, and so you can get them almost everywhere.
Yeah, it reminds me of growing up in Edison, New Jersey. And you just said sometimes you're on the road. I have another fast food memory. I was in L.A. also last year, driving from L.A. to Orland, California, to the Farm Sanctuary Shelter to speak at the Hoedown. I was with Michelle Sass, my former colleague at Farm Sanctuary, and she said she always stops at Carl's Jr. on the way. So we pulled in through the drive-thru, and we got fried zucchini and, like, French fries on the side.
Oh, my God.
And it was so good.
Yeah, I'm sure it was good, but that sounds just sinful. I've never been to a Carl Jr.'s. Are they a California?
Yeah, I think they might be beyond just California, but they're not out here.
I mean, I've certainly heard of them, but...
And slightly tangentially, on that same trip, we were on the highway. What's that highway that goes... It's 5.
Highway
5.
Okay.
We were driving up to Orland, and we were going like 80 miles an hour in her little convertible, and there was a sign that said, vegetarian food, next rest stop.
Yay.
So we pulled over. It was an Indian place, and we got samosas or something.
That's always nice to see.
It was. But back to the issue at hand, there are a bunch of vegan fast food options. Everything from Applebee's, which has sizzling vegetable skillet and steamed vegetable plate, and you can get nachos plain.
Well, what would be nachos plain?
Well, I mean, honestly, I've done chips. That before. I've been at restaurants before and gotten nachos plain, and I've had it with salsa, and I've had them put beans on it, and just whatever vegetables they have. It is good. I mean, you know, at first you feel like you're deprived because you don't have your guacamole and your, you know, diet cheese or whatever, but then you realize it's all in how you look at it. It is very good. And even, you know, Boston Market has vegan options. They have... according to PETA,
I'm not going to Boston Market.
I'm not either.
I'm sorry.
I'm not either, but I'm just saying that if that's all somebody has, according to PETA, they have a bunch of vegan options, including their applesauce and their fruit salad.
Who wants applesauce?
Their zucchini marinara. I don't know. This is according to PETA. But lots of places, Burger King has vegan food, and Chili's has lots of vegan options. They have...
Yeah, well, they have a pretty big menu.
Right. They have chips and salsa and veggie quesadilla without cheese.
I'm not saying that anybody should eat at these places. They are terrible.
Right.
They're evil.
And remember...
They're destroying America. I understand that. But, you know, sometimes you gotta eat.
And Denny's just...
Well, yeah. They just took their veggie burger and made it vegan. That's good news.
Very good news. So, and I agree with you. You know, I really opt not to eat at these places, but I don't have a car, and I live in New York City.
I'm just looking at this list, and it says the Krispy Kreme's fruit pies are vegan. I don't even want to have that information in my head.
Well, I think that should be double-checked. It doesn't seem like it would be, but according to PETA's website...
Is this PETA?
No. But... No, we got it from PETA. PETA linked to this. It's a blog called My Life as a Vegan. We found
all right.
It from PETA. That's why we got here from PETA. Okay. But anyway, so, you know, you
can... All right, let's hear what other people said.
Google it. Google vegan fast food, and you'll be shocked at everything that you come up with. Right. Well, let's save the biggest one for last. But some people said Moe's, which I've never heard of.
No idea.
Moe's, I guess, is in certain areas. And some other people said falafel, which isn't a chain. I don't know many fast food places that...
I guess we didn't specify chain, and falafels are the classic fast food on the streets of New York, that's for sure. I do love them dearly.
A few people said McAllister's, plain baked potato and veg chili from McAllister's. I don't know what McAllister's is either.
No, but that sounds tasty.
My favorite answer was from Allison Cole from Liberation BC and from, of course, Animal Voices Vancouver. My favorite answer, she said, a veggie dog at any random hot dog cart in the city. You know why she said that? Because she's showing off.
Yeah.
Because she lives in Vancouver, and you could go to any corner and get a vegan hot dog, and boy, oh boy, did we when we were in Vancouver.
Yeah, they were tasty.
She's showing off. Anyway, by a landslide, the winner was Chipotle.
Yeah, not surprisingly.
Not surprisingly at all. There's so many things you could get. I mean, there are certain Chipotle chains that have, that even carry Gardein now.
Yeah, I think they're pretty limited, but I hope they're going to grow.
Honestly,
there is one not too far from us.
I know, but I don't, I like the regular one without, you know, the regular vegan one that has beans, and you could get lots of guacamole on it if you want, and yeah, all the vegetables you want.
I agree. I don't think the the Gardein adds that much. It's nice to see it there, but I just love their regular burrito. You do have to be very careful, though. You get the black beans, not the red beans. The red beans are not vegan.
That's crazy.
I know. It's so stupid.
People must really make that mistake a lot.
Huh. I hope I'm right, but, well, actually, I hope I'm wrong, but I think I'm right.
Right. Well, Chipotle, that I would say 90% of the people who responded to this voted for Chipotle, so
Well, they are yummy.
Yeah, and, you know, maybe I shouldn't have posed this question.
I know, because
I want one, and I want the Carl's Jr. fried zucchini, and a side of French fries.
All right, stop it, stop
it. Okay, I'm stopping, I'm sorry. And you know, it's just, if you plan the right way and you have lists in front of you during your road trips, then you might just find some scrumptious, maybe bad for you, but scrumptious vegan food.
Fruit pies from Krispy Kreme. Oh my God.
I'm going to Google that. Anyway, that was our show for today. Yet another podcast has come and gone, and you were here to experience the joy.
And try to eat better than we are talking about.
So if you liked what you were listening to, please consider helping support our hen house by making a donation. We do need donations in order to continue to provide a voice for the animals and do what we do. And we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, so your donations are, guess what, tax deductible. So please go to our website, ourhenhouse.org, and any donation, $5, $7, $10, $1,000, whatever you got, we won't turn it down. And while you're at our website, please check out our blog and our video page, and find us on Facebook, become our Facebook fan, and email us, let us know what's going on, info@ourhenhouse.org, and let us know what the story is. And if you like what you're listening to, please also consider leaving a friendly comment on iTunes. It does make a big difference for us in terms of our listenership. So that's about all I have for you today. Is that all you have?
I'm tapped out.
Marianne's eating a burrito as we speak. So thank you so much for joining us, and we will talk to you next week, which will be episode 40. Peace out.